Hey, this is Joe. I'm watching the Bears game, and you're listening to Mike Steven on Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thanks, Joe. Go Bears. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It is lovely to be here with you today for show number 987. And what we do here on the program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today, as usual, in the WGN radio studio. And yeah, you heard Joe watching the Bears. Here we go with another season. And we all love the Bears around here, but new research is throwing a bit of shade on our game day experience at Soldier Field. According to a study from Pickwise, which apparently is a media company that provides free sports betting picks and analysis, Soldier Field has officially been crowned the worst NFL stadium for game day traffic. To which I say, no kidding. The fan experience at Soldier Field is not great. I'm thinking about getting in and out of that place. It kind of requires a hiking expedition of sorts. I remember I was there in May seeing AC/DC, and from the time I got out of the stadium to when I was able to actually get an Uber home was an hour. Here are the numbers. Traffic congestion around Soldier Field spikes by an eye-popping 42% on game day. It's the biggest increase in the entire league. For perspective, the NFL average is just over 25%. So Chicago is in a league of its own. And some of the highest local pollution levels around Soldier Field on game day as well. So Soldier Field's ranking highlights just how tough it is for fans and tourists to get in and out of a Bears game. We got clogged roads, sluggish travel times, polluted air. And then when we do get to the stadium, we hope and pray that what we see on the field is actually watchable. So keep the faith, Chicago. Maybe we'll have better luck traveling to Arlington Heights? Huh? Hey, speaking of traveling, we'll talk about transportation in Illinois today. There's a $771 million transit fiscal cliff that we are facing. On the show, we will hear from a transit activist reporting on this issue, and we will hear from one of the state representatives working to avert driving off the fiscal cliff. Also, we'll get an update on new rules about communication intended for those who are incarcerated in state prisons. Keep on Bearsing, Bears fans. See ya at Soldier Field. Maybe. Okay, maybe at the tailgate in the parking lot. Sound good? Public transportation. So many of us rely on it every day. And a healthy public transit system is one of the hallmarks of a properly functioning city. Chicago depends on public transit, but so do many other municipalities across the state. Public transit in Illinois is facing some tough times once again. COVID stimulus money runs out in 2026, and this means that the CTA, PACE, and METRA will need to reduce service by about 40% and lay off approximately 3,000 employees if there's no movement on the gap in the budget. And that gap is about $771 million. Not great. So what's being done about this? Well, the Illinois State Senate passed a bill called HB 34338, which aims to provide funding and reform for the state's transportation. But the Illinois House didn't vote on the legislation before it adjourned for the summer. That means there's still the looming question of what the future of public transportation in Illinois is. And to explore this question, John Greenfield joins us. He is the editor of Streets Blog Chicago. That is a daily nonprofit newsroom and transit advocacy organization advocating for livable streets, covering local transportation. John, welcome back to the show. It's nice to have you here again.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
You got it. And joining us also is Illinois State Representative Cam Buckner of the Illinois 26th Legislative District, who has been working hard on this issue in the General Assembly. Representative Buckner, great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So Lots to talk about here. John, let me just go to you first. Your coverage, I have to say, on Streets Blog, chi.streetsblog.org is the website. It's been extensive. It's been thorough on, I guess, what you want to call a transit fiscal cliff. But sometimes this can be confusing for people when we hear about this. So just briefly here to kind of set the scene with your coverage, what were you trying to do here? Were you trying to get into the policy? Were you trying to look at how this impacts our daily lives when we talk about transit?
I guess my biggest goal with this, our coverage of the subject, and I think of all the news outlets in town, I think we've had some of the closest coverage of it and the most obsessive coverage of it, if you want to be honest, is I really want to make sure this issue doesn't fall off people's radar. And I think there's a danger of that happening. I think this is a topic that might not be that interesting for a lot of everyday Chicagoans if they aren't aware of exactly what's going on. But they are going to get very interested if, you know, 40% of bus and train service gets cut off. They're going to be very interested if lots of people lose jobs over this. We have a lot more unemployed people. They're going to be very interested, even if they don't use transit, if suddenly our roads and expressways are choked with a lot more cars. We have a lot more pollution, a lot more traffic crashes because fewer people are riding transit. So I really want people to take this issue seriously, and I want them to hold our lawmakers accountable. I don't want this to be a situation like Philadelphia, where they are basically, they're doing drastic cuts to their transit system. They did about a 20% fare hike. All this really bad stuff is happening to public transportation in Philadelphia that we do not want happening in Chicagoland. So I want to make sure the word gets out there.
Yeah. And I think it is important that people know what's going on here. And I'm excited to have you here, John, and also someone who's really in the thick of it, Representative Buckner. I know that you have taken a leadership role on this issue, and you've been working hard on this over the summer. We'll talk about that. But I said that the Senate passed this bill, this reform bill, but the House did not. So my question for you is twofold. So first of all, what does this bill do? And the second question is, why didn't the House vote on this issue?
Yeah, so this bill does a couple of things. We kind of siloed it in the beginning conversations to make sure that we dealt with the revenue issue to make sure that we were going to be able to pay for the services and to create the system that we deserve in Northeast Illinois. But we also, and first what we did, but also we put together a group of policy pieces that would change the governance and the structure of transit in Northeast Illinois. For us, it was important. Our rallying cry was no revenue without reform. And what that meant was that we cannot throw good money after bad and not have things in the system change. Anyone who rides the CTA, Metro, or PACE understands that while it is a system that is the lifeblood of this region, that there are things that have gone wrong for a long time that need to be addressed. And so it was important to us in Springfield to make sure that we weren't just finding a way to pay for transit and making it, you know, the same system that we had pre-pandemic, but that we were creating the system that we have always deserved to have with the right reforms and governance, structural changes in play to do that. And I'm very proud that we've gotten as far as we have in this conversation. To your point, the Senate did pass a bill late on May 31st, which for those who follow Springfield, they know that constitutionally that is the last day of session. By the time the House got the bill from the Senate, it was close to, I think, 11:45, 11:47 at night, which, you know, only allowed 10 to 15 minutes to look at the bill and to move forward. You know, Springfield has a sordid history, and you often hear people talk about things that were passed in the middle of the night or passed under the cloak of darkness without input from people. What Speaker Welch and the leadership in the House decided to do was that we would not put that Senate bill on the board in the last hour, in the last 15 minutes, because we thought the people of Illinois deserved an honest conversation about it, that we would spend some time over the summertime, which we have been doing, talking about what we're going to do and how we move the system forward. And so, you know, it's very important to us that we get this done, and we are convinced and committed to doing that. And I just remind folks, Mike, that the transit cliff is not a headline. I know we're talking a lot about it as a headline.
Right.
And the broader news, it is literally real life. This is your bus that never shows up. This is your shift that you can't reach. This is your kid's class that they can't get to. We either fix it now or we pay for the collapse later.
And, you know, I appreciate you saying that. And really, when you think about it like that, the monumental impact that this has on so many folks, it is so vast. And I agree with you. We need to get this right. And so you're saying, look, instead of getting this bill 13 minutes before midnight, maybe we take the summer and we try to hash this out and see what's actually in there. We'll come back to what you've been doing over the summer in a minute here, Representative Buckner. John, I know that you have interviewed other members of the General Assembly. You've talked to some key players politically on this issue. Speaker Welch is someone that you did interview as well. And I think that's interesting in terms of the overall narrative of the story. So in terms of you doing that, what do you think those interviews, when we think about the narrative and the perspective of this story, what do those interviews bring to this overall story?
It's been a very interesting process. I think at this point I've interviewed 8 or 9 different Springfield legislators about this issue. You know, to his credit, Representative Buckner pointed out that it had all been guys up to the point I talked to him. So he suggested that I contact his colleague, Leader Eva Dina Delgado, who's helping lead the Working Committee on Transit with Representative Buckner. And we had a great interview. But, you know, one thing that was really interesting, I talked to a bunch of Democrats, 7 or 8 Democrats from both the House and the Senate. And they're, you know, they're all friendly. They're all pro-transit Democrats. But there seems to be a little bit of a he said, she said thing going on. The senator seemed annoyed that they were able to get their bill passed on May 31st. And the House didn't vote for it. And, you know, I don't think anyone thinks the House was unreasonable to not vote for it at the last minute. But they're waiting for the House to come up with their alternative plan if they don't want to vote for the Senate plan. Whereas the House has been saying, you know, both Speaker Welch and Representative Buckner and some other folks, Leader Delgado, that they want to really get it right. They want to have, you know, an excellent plan, get the $1.5 billion in funding, make sure it's equitable, you know, have fair funding sources. And, you know, I think there's a little bit of an issue of we really don't want to not pass any bill at all before the transit agencies have to fire people, you know, put out pink slips and cut service for 2026. So I don't think they should let the perfect be the enemy of the good here. They shouldn't like work so hard. And I respect all the work and research they're doing, but I know people are going to be very upset if nothing gets passed in time for them to avoid these cuts. You know, you asked about like what the interviews did for me. One really interesting interview I had last week was with the only Republican I've spoken to so far. That is Senator Don DeWitt, who represents the far northwest suburbs. And, you know, I was sort of bracing myself for that to be a conflict-ridden interview. But actually, even though all the Republican senators voted against the HB 3438 that passed in May, he is a pretty pro-transit guy. He was on the Regional Transportation Authority board for several years. A bunch of legislators and other officials even took a fact-finding trip to Germany in December to learn about how the excellent transit system in Germany works and came back with a lot of notes. So that was a very interesting conversation. And, you know, I respect the way Representative Buckner is handling this issue. And I actually respected the way this Republican was discussing it. I don't think he was unreasonable. But the big differences between the way the Democrats and this Republican I spoke to talked was that Senator DeWitt, you know, he feels like we really should focus on finding the $771 million right now, and we'll worry about getting the extra $1.5 billion to improve the system in the future. And he's really against raising taxes. So he wants to use existing funding to find that $771 million. He mentioned there's the Wayfair tax on purchases made online from out of state. The labor unions have agreed to allow interest from the road building fund to be used. And DeWitt also called for Governor Pritzker to use the $300 million rainy day fund to fund transit. So those are things that would all add up to about $771 million, or pretty close. So that could save the day for, you know, next year. But I talked to Leader Delgado yesterday, and she said she doesn't think it's a good idea to patch this with the rainy day fund, because we're going to have a budget gap the year after that, and then where will we get money?
Representative Buckner, let's kind of take what John just said and what you've been doing. I know you've been working over the summer. You are part of this transit working group. Can you take us inside that group? What are some things that you're discussing? What are some things that you're hearing from people across Illinois?
Yeah, so we continue to speak with our working group members about, once again, governance and structure, how the processes and the actual entities work. I'm talking about board composition and what that looks like, talking about voting thresholds and all of those conversations. And those are very important. We also are having some very earnest conversations about what mixture, what cocktail of revenue is palatable for the folks who would have to vote on this, right? As we've always said, both Leader Delgado and I are Chicago members, but we understand that this has to be something that affects the entire state and that we have to have real conversations with our neighbors in the suburbs. In fact, I spoke just a few days ago with a number of county board chairs in the collar counties, and what my message was to them, and I totally mean this, is that this reform can't happen to the collar counties. It has to happen with the collar counties, right? And so these are the conversations that we've been having. Our working group is comprised of 14 members of the Democratic caucus from all over the state and mainly the region. Folks in Will County and DuPage County, and obviously Cook and Lake and McHenry, but also Speaker Welch, to his credit, knew that this was a bipartisan issue. And John talked a bit about his conversation with Don DeWitt. Don DeWitt is a friend of mine. We talk regularly. In fact, I was in the middle of a gym workout 2 days ago when he called, and I had to stop, and we spent an hour on the phone talking about transit, right? But he cares about it, yeah. And it's a big deal. And Speaker Welch knows that this can't be one-sided. And so him and Leader McCombie talked about this. And now Representative Leader Brad Stevens is on the working group as well. And so bringing a Republican voice who is in a district that has some pieces of Chicago, but obviously adjacent to the city, and understands the interplay between RTA, Metro, PACE, and CTA. And so we've been having these conversations. We've been meeting in person every week since we get out of session. And we are now at the point where we're trying to fine tune what the final product would be so we can deliver the people of Illinois what they deserve.
I just think it's important to call something out here, because in this time when, you know, we say we're so polarized and we're in our certain camps here, the fact that you've got Democrats and Republicans in Illinois working together from different parts of the state, which I've also spoken with many other members of the General Assembly. That happens. It has to happen. So it happens a lot. But I think it's important to say, look, we are, regardless of party here, everyone, Democrats, Republicans, everybody in between, they ride public transportation, right?
That's
they,
right.
They go to work. They use this stuff. So I just think it's important to call that out, that you're working across the aisle. You're working outside of Chicago. And we can't always say that, because I don't think we always know that happens, but that does happen, doesn't it?
And it's important for people to know that, right? That transit is one of my loves, not just because I use it and it's been such an integral part of my life, but transit in a space where things are hyper partisan. And listen, I'm a politician. I like some of the rough and tumble that comes with many of the issues that we fight about, because I think they're real ideological battles. But this one is not. Transit is not a partisan issue. It's how people get to work. Roads aren't Republican and rails aren't Democrats. You know, a nurse's 3 a.m. shift, a student's 8 a.m. class, a vet doctor's visit, none of that checks party ID. Good transit means jobs show up. It means classrooms fill up. It means small businesses open on time and remain in business. So if we can agree that we have to fund it with clear metrics, on make it on time, make it clean, make it safe, and let the riders see the score. That's not left or right. That's how a state and in cities should work. And so I'm glad that we have, I think, put down our arms when it comes to some of the partisan fights. We can fight about other things, and we will. This is not one of those fights.
Yeah. And John, before I ask Representative Buckner where we're at and where we're going here, I just want to kind of ask you, because you've been reporting on issues of transportation for years. And I know on Streets Blog, you've looked at the history of the ups and downs with public transportation here. And even though there is this budget gap when it comes to the public transportation right now and into next year, we've been down this road before. It's not exactly the same, but it's a similar kind of path. So as you look back at the history in Illinois at transportation, is there anything that we can learn from that history that we might apply to where we are in 2025?
Well, I'm trying to remember the exact year this happened. I think this was under Emanuel. I mean, there were some, maybe it was around 2008, there were some serious bus cuts. I don't know. I mean, you know, one of the things that you guys brought up that I think is worth mentioning is this could be a real win-win situation for the Democrats and the Republicans. It would be great if people from different parties can come together and say, like, hey, we have a common enemy here, the transit fiscal cliff. Let's work together and solve this. That said, I mean, it is a real sticky wicket because you got different people want different things. You know, the Republicans feel very different about finances and taxes than the Democrats do. And there's also conflict between the two houses to some extent and regional stuff. I mean, one cool thing about HB 3438, I don't think we discussed yet, is that it would send $200 million to downstate transit. You know, there are a lot of downstate college towns, for example, that have good transit systems. There's lots of transit ridership in Champaign-Urbana, where the University of Illinois is. Senator DeWitt gave me a good example of bipartisanship in Illinois, that when Governor Pritzker first took office, they passed the $45 billion Rebuild Illinois legislation for infrastructure, which has gotten a lot of good things done since then. And DeWitt was involved with that. And he said that was a situation where Republicans and Democrats joined forces and got something constructive done. So hopefully we'll see something like that happen here.
And that leads into my last question for Representative Buckner. Where are we? I know that there is the fall session that is on the horizon here, but in terms of what you've been working on over the summer, all the work that you've put in here, the folks that you've been talking to, where are we? And it sounds like you're optimistic. So what do you think's on the horizon here?
Yeah, so I am. I remain optimistic, and my optimism really is undergirded by the fact that I know that we've been doing this work, and I see how close we are in this space. I want to just start this answer by reminding folks that, as John said, that this is not hypothetical. It's not theoretical. We've got a real issue on our hands, and we've got to deal with it. And the results, if we don't, are going to be dire. I know John talked about the last time that CTA made bus cuts. I think he's probably referring to 2010 when Ron was mayor, when he first became mayor. Rich Rodriguez was the president of the CTA. There were huge cuts made then. I think almost 20% of service was reduced. Again, in 2012, when Forrest Claypool ran the CTA, they eliminated maybe a dozen bus routes around the city. And one of the ones that got the most publicity was the number 11 Lincoln route just south of Western, where there was a lot of conversations about what that meant for the infrastructure of the city. And so we got to avoid that. We got to avoid that at all costs. And so I truly do believe that we're close. Veto session is earlier this year than it normally is. It's in October and not November. So we'll be heading back in about 5 weeks. And in those weeks, we'll be able to put together a product that is deserving of what the people of Illinois need and want from this system. And so while I know folks are worried that, you know, we're taking our time, but they're not hearing enough, this is a generational piece of legislation, and we've got to be smart about it and make sure we don't just get it done, but get it right. And so I'm always encouraged and kind of pushed in the right direction by a quote from one of my favorite Chicagoans, the great writer Nelson Algren, who said that Chicago is a ninth inning kind of town. The game is not over till the last man is out. And so we're not done yet. We got work to do, but we will get there.
All right. Well, here we go. Maybe moving into the bottom of the ninth. And hopefully this gets done. I share your optimism. I'm excited to see what happens here. I'm excited that everyone's working together. I mean, that's where we're at. But look, I think we need to celebrate that. And you have people who are being trying to be thoughtful here, working on behalf of all of us in Illinois. Representative Cam Buckner of the Illinois 26th Legislative District and John Greenfield, editor of Streets Blog Chicago. Thank you so much for your time today, for all of your hard work reporting on this and in the conversations and getting the politics on this done. Thank you both so much for being here, and let's hope for great public transportation going forward.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks a lot.
An eye on our state prisons is an important ongoing task, especially since transparency hasn't always been a priority of the correctional system. In August, the Illinois Department of Corrections issued emergency amendments to prison rules, now under review by the Joint Committee on Administrative Rules. These changes affect nearly 30,000 incarcerated people and their loved ones, introducing email and copy systems while incarcerated, new procedures for handling privileged legal mail, and stricter rules on how publications can be received. Jennifer Volen-Katz is the executive director of the John Howard Association. That's a locally based prison watchdog organization, and she joins us today to discuss what's going on with this issue. Jenny, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. We can check out your organization, thejha.org, I should say. So, okay, we hear what's going on here. And I want you to, if you could, just unpack this a little bit for us, because practically, what does this mean? I mean, if people are incarcerated, they can get communication from the outside. They can get mail. And it sounds like that these emergency amendments really sort of put some constraints and change some procedures with communication from the outside to those who are incarcerated. Is that right?
That's exactly right, Mike. And, you know, one of the things that's concerning about this is that in filing emergency amendments with the Joint Committee on Administrative Rules, the Illinois Department of Corrections had to characterize the situation as an emergency. That's what the emergency rule process exists for. And as a threshold matter, the situation that they are trying to correct for is something that's been ongoing for a while with very little information, data, or evidence to suggest that it has changed and gone from an ongoing problem to an emergency. So one of the things that concerns us is this feels a little bit like an end run around two things. Number one, the rulemaking process, although I suspect they will have a proposed rule sometime soon, and that will kick off the more typical rulemaking process. But the other thing is, you know, the day after IDOC filed these emergency amendments with JCAR, the governor signed SB 2201. And that is a law that mandates the collection of prison contraband data and the public reporting of it. So the agency had already been mandated to start collecting the information that's needed to really evaluate the problem they're trying to correct for in order to use the data and information to generate effective solutions. And so this emergency rule kind of, you know, gets ahead of all of that and seeks to make changes that are going to be very painful for the people inside without any reason to believe that this is going to keep people safe, that this is going to make a difference and address the ongoing problem.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to figure out what the emergency is here and what the big problem is. We talk about contraband coming into a prison from the outside, and sure, we don't want that to happen. But in terms of going about it like this and targeting specifically communication like mail, I'm trying to figure out what it doesn't make sense to me. How is this connected?
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you. So, you know, I will say anecdotally, you know, there is evidence to suggest that, you know, drug use inside prisons is up for a number of reasons. A lot of it has to do with lack of productive programming and time spent in cell due to lockdown-like conditions. And this has been an ongoing issue. And, you know, you may recall about a year ago, there were a lot of reports coming mostly from correctional staff about exposures and possible overdoses from drug use inside the prisons by the people who are incarcerated. And we certainly don't want to diminish the seriousness of that. However, in a lot of those cases, you know, there was contradictory information as to whether or not illegal drugs had actually been involved, whether there actually was a medical emergency. And so in order to better understand the problem, we worked with legislators on SB 2201 to identify the kind of information and data that's needed to better evaluate this problem so that solutions can be put in place that will be more effective at keeping the people who are incarcerated and the people who work in the prisons safe. I mean, that's an important thing to do, and we absolutely, you know, support efforts to do that. What we don't support is calling something that's ongoing an emergency in order to make immediate changes to the rule. And also putting forward a solution that, you know, is not necessarily evidence-based and likely to be effective in addressing the problem.
So that proposed solution, I guess we could use that word in quotes. When we think about what's happening here, I said that there are changes to the communication systems here. But what does that mean if someone's incarcerated? Take us through that. If someone's in prison, they get some communication. It's not a lot. But what happens now with these amendments in terms of the communication that someone could receive while incarcerated?
Sure. So the amendments as written do three different things. The first thing is allow for universal mail scanning. And what that means is that people who are incarcerated will not receive the original letters that were sent to them by their loved ones and outside supports. Those letters will either be photocopied and delivered to them or scanned and sent to them digitally via their tablets, which may not sound like a big deal to people who are not familiar with the prison environment, but for people who are incarcerated and their loved ones, it's a very big deal. First of all, those letters are a touchstone for people who are incarcerated. They provide emotional connection, and they are also often things that people hold on to for a long period of time. You know, people who are incarcerated for decades and decades, you know, I'm told by some in my network, you know, they will keep those letters to remind them of milestones that they've missed or of important news that was shared with them. You know, the letter itself is important to them and something they return to over and over again. Mm-hmm. So denying people the physical mail is something that people inside will find very painful. You know, there is also evidence to suggest that mail from the outside is really not the way in which drug contraband comes into prisons. It's certainly not the main way it comes into prisons. So we're denying people something that's very important to them, you know, without reason to believe that that is the main entryway for the contraband that is creating a dangerous situation. The second thing the rules do is require additional steps for privileged mail. They talk about a multi-factor authentication system and control numbers and tracking privileged mail. And one of our concerns around that is that it may have a chilling effect on people's engagement with privileged mail. And full disclosure, the John Howard Association, while not mandated oversight in the state of Illinois, we are articulated as a privileged mail recipient from the Illinois Department of Corrections. So it's our organization, it's other state agencies, and it's people's attorneys that represent them. Typically, that's the universe of privileged mail. And, you know, we want people to reach out. We want to provide people with confidential ways of reaching out beyond prisons to ask for help or report issues. And this may have a chilling effect on their willingness to do that. And then the third thing the rule does is change how publications can be received by people who are incarcerated. And I think the big change, the noteworthy change, is that outside supports are no longer permitted to bring approved publications to someone in custody in an IDOC facility. So before this rule change, people could bring up to 5 approved publications with them when they came to visit a loved one in prison, provided they comported with certain standards and rules. And this rule takes away their ability to do that.
So I'm just thinking, as you're saying what these proposed amendments do, just to put this in context of why we should care, why this is a big deal, I know of 2 people that I've spoken to on this program who were wrongfully convicted. And I know one of those people, Tyrone Hood, he had a pen pal program with someone who got him connected with a pro bono legal organization that took up his case, that reopened it, and eventually, after many years, worked to get him out of prison and then ultimately his name cleared. And I'm thinking of someone I interviewed recently who was bringing books about growing up on the west side of Chicago as a Black woman, to share that experience with those who are incarcerated, disproportionately people of color incarcerated, and what a powerful experience that was. So for those folks who are inside, I mean, this communication, and for what you said too, with the emotional connection to family and friends and loved ones, I mean, this has a really big potential for significant repercussions here.
I think that's exactly right, Mike. And I think it's really important for the legislators who make decisions on this, who sit on the committee, to really understand the impacts that these emergency amendments are going to have on people. And I think it's also really important to understand that, you know, there has been thought given to how to better understand the problem and create solutions for it. So to move ahead, you know, in this direction that is going to negatively impact people, that is going to be a real pain point for people inside, without reason to believe it's going to stop the flow of illegal drug contraband into prisons, I think is, you know, I can't stress enough how important it is to consider that, you know, and looking at these amendments. You know, people have a right to their mail, and I, you know, IDOC is certainly aware that people have a legal right to receive mail, and, you know, but they don't have a right to receive it in a particular format. But I think what's really troubling here is that the agency is moving forward with a process that lacks transparency in order to, you know, push through a rule without getting the necessary information to understand the impact that rule is going to have positively and negatively, you know, and it's that's deeply problematic. And again, there is a new law mandating the collection and reporting of prison contraband. You know, that information is going to give us a much clearer picture of how the drugs are getting into prisons. And, you know, I think it's important to note that there are other jurisdictions who have done this same thing, moved to mail scanning in order to deal with drugs inside prisons. And in at least 2 instances, in Missouri and in Pennsylvania, after they moved to mail scanning for the people in custody, drug overdoses increased inside their prisons. So the mail was not the way, you know, that contraband was getting into the prisons. And so I think we need to look at other jurisdictions who have done this before us, you know, for information that could be very useful to us in creating responses that will be effective at keeping people safe.
So what's the next step here? We have a process problem, it sounds like, a transparency issue, but also just the human impact. Where do we go from here?
So the next thing that's going to happen is on Tuesday, September 16th, the committee is holding public hearings. The only witnesses will be the agency. So it's not a chance for other people to weigh in, although the John Howard Association and several other advocacy groups have issued statements or letters that are now being made public and shared with legislators to outline the problem, you know, hoping to build awareness of the issues and fill in some of the information that may be missing when people just read the amended language to the rule submitted by IDOC. So while we won't be able to testify, certainly the John Howard Association plans to attend that hearing to get a better sense of, you know, what IDOC is planning, why they're doing this, and also to hear, you know, what questions legislators have about this rule change.
All right. Well, I know you will be keeping an eye on this issue at the John Howard Association. That is a locally based prison watchdog organization and doing some really important work here. The website, thejha.org, and Jennifer Vollenkatz is the executive director of the John Howard Association. Jenny, I always appreciate your time and all of your hard work. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to discuss this issue with you.
And that will do it. Outside the Loop show number 987 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show today. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his wonderful engineering skills in the WGN radio studio. I hope you have a wonderful week. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.